Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. I'm Charlie. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Boy, am I glad to be here. We'll talk a little bit about that, but it could have gone either way. We just spent an hour and a half at the border, and that was it was my fault, and it wasn't bad for me. The last time I was at the border, I got arrested, so an hour and a half was pretty good time for us, except for Chris was still working on breakfast. About 3 o'clock, he started getting a little grumpy, but we're real happy to be here. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985, and that is the most important thing that ever happened in my life. My home group is the Primary Purpose Group in Austin, Texas, and we would welcome you. If you find yourself in Austin, Texas on a Tuesday night, come see us. We think it's a terrific meeting. We usually have about 150 to 175 people on Tuesday night studying the big book line by line, word by word. We've been doing it. We just had our fourth anniversary, and we're on our third pass through the book. We're going to roll into, we just did the hour this week, and we're going to do 6 and 7 next week. So, that's how far we are into our third pass. So it's really been fun. And I love the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love any time I get a chance to get up and talk about what we do here in AA and what's happened to us and stuff. I want to thank Ron for asking us to come up here. It's a real honor. I mean, Chris and I had the same sponsor, and Chris was with Mark a lot longer than I was, but the 4 years that I spent with him, I haven't made it through a talk yet talking about Mark since he died, but it was a very formative 4 years for me. And we miss Mark a great deal, but Chris was supposed to do this thing with Mark. And those are big shoes to fill, so they brought both of us, And I still don't know if we can do it, but I miss Mark. I love Mark. But Ron asked us to come up here, and then Marcus picked us up at the airport. I don't think he knew what he was getting into. But he did a fine job of driving us up here. And thank God he was in a rental car, because when I looked back and they were pulling his back seat out and had a guy on a creepy crawly underneath it and they were ripping the dash out, I'm like, I'm glad you came in a rental, Marcus. Welcome to Charlie Parker. Was that 6:20 by that clock? What does it say right now? 6:25? Katie's really worried about how long I'm going to go tonight. She's got 40 minutes and I got 40 minutes. But in Texas with community property law, the way I see it, we got 80 minutes between us, So I really hope we get to hear from Katie tonight. The last time Katie was speaking in Vancouver one time, and I'm going to try to give the shortest version of this story I've ever given, but she was speaking in Vancouver, I don't know, a year ago, a little over a year ago, and we got to the airport and they wouldn't let her get on with the little plastic card. They said, you have to drive across with that. So I'm think, and then I go, well, fly us to Seattle. It's only like an hour from Seattle to Vancouver, right? And well, it's like a 4-hour death march from Seattle to Vancouver. But we drive, and when we get to the border, this is the first time I've ever had it on me. I pull out my passport in this groovy little leather case that I carried in because I'm a big deal, and I hand the lady my case in the little booth, and she pulls it out of the case, and she holds it up, and she looks at the document page, and she goes, you're handing me a Korean passport with your picture in it? And I go, what? You know, and that's when it all started. You know, I mean, so she slams that window shut like, you know, they surround us like SWAT team. They pull us out of the car. You know, they're badgering me with questions. I don't know what to, you know, I don't know whether to answer this question or listen to that question. And at one point, the guy goes, "Your story is weak." And I'm like, "Oh, it damn sure is. I mean, I got no story, you know. I mean, you know, I've run a few scams. I'd have a better story than this, you know. But, I mean, but, you know, long story short, it appears that someone had stolen my passport at some point and copied it on a color copier machine, cut that document page out. I hope I'm not giving anybody any ideas. Glued that document page into a worthless Korean passport, stuck it back in my little leather case, stuck it back in my briefcase, and made off with my U.S. passport. And, you know, it's till I walk up to the Canadian border like a dope and hand them this Korean passport. And so, I mean, it took almost 5 months working through the United States Senator's office to get myself another passport because I don't have a sterling background, you know. Today was the first time we've tried to use it since I got the new one. And, you know, I hadn't signed it yet. And then we get to the border, and she's, you know, wanting to know about my arrest record. And I'm like, well, it's not as bad as it looks, you know. Most of those I was, you know, managed to get not guilty or deferred adjudication or something. But, you know, and as alcoholics, am I the only one that has a sense of entitlement? I mean, there's a part of me that wants to go, come on, that arrest was 36 years ago, you know, and they don't care, you know. So we were there an hour and a half, and it looked like everything was going pretty good. And then she goes, "Mr. Parker, come back in." And I walk back in, and she goes, "Korean passport?" I'm like, oh. I was really hoping you didn't hear that part, you know. And so I had to tell her the whole story. But anyway, we're here, and we're darn glad to be here. We're going to each talk a little bit. You know, and I'm really looking forward to this weekend. Chris is a good friend of ours, and he's been one of my heroes for a long time. I mean, you know, when I was in middle of the road AA, Chris spoke to me. And, you know, I come from a Southern Baptist background. You can just bring it as hard as you want to a guy like me. I respond to that. And a lot of what he was talking about. And then, you know, eventually winding up in the lineage with Mark Houston and some of those guys. There's a lot of good AA there, and in the past 7 or 8 years, you know, we've really been finding, you know, there's pockets of enthusiasm all around, you know, London, Ontario, and Louisville, Kentucky, and, you know, just wherever you go, there are always little. It's funny because I had just had a sponsee move to Houston. He's a good boy. He's one of my best guys, and I said, get down there and go, where do those kind of annoying, a little over the top big book thumpers go, you know, and that's because that's where you're going to want to wind up, you know, and they can usually tell you, but that hadn't always been my experience, and I hope that's a lot of what we get a chance to talk about this, you know, because, well, how many people in the room have, say, less than 6 months of sobriety? Excellent. Okay. And how many have over 10 years? Wow, fantastic, fantastic. It's a funny time in AA, and, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about what it was like, you know, what happened. Not much, though. I mean, but we are supposed to be telling our stories tonight, and I mean, I literally ran right from the car, and where's my man Kevin? He saw me in my underwear in the bathroom, and I was like, you know, do I pray while I'm, you know, getting dressed, or, you know, it's all good, you know, we could still be at the border. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. I grew up in a pretty normal family, if there is such a thing, you know. I mean, I really like the saying that normal is a setting on a washing machine, but it was normal enough, you know. There wasn't any real obvious dysfunction in our house. Nobody was drinking. Nobody was knocking each other around. You know, I've heard a lot of fifth steps over the years, and I've heard enough to know that I had it pretty good growing up. I mean, it was a pretty normal household. I grew up under the burden. Anybody else grew up under the burden of potential? Anybody? Oh, my God. I mean, that was like all I heard about was, you know, why can't you live up to your potential? Why can't you be more like, you know, Charles Malira across the street, you know? And I just remember thinking, it's flattering, Mom, but I'm really not holding back that much, you know? I mean, this is you're kind of getting my best shot here, you know? But my mother was a first grade school teacher for 42 years, and I was well prepared for the first grade. Kind of kicked ass, you know, all the way up to maybe fifth grade, you know, but you know, it was a normal, except my sister was perfect. I had one of those sisters, she's 5 years older, she was all everything, you know, she was drum majorette, first chair flute player, National Honor Society, you name it, you know, and then she's got this thuggish little brother, but I think it was a lot easier to just kind of scale it off and go the other way. But I mean, I was getting, you know, all the stuff they were saying not to do, I couldn't wait to do. And, you know, and I was always, they used to talk about high IQ and stuff like that. When you say that to a self-centered alcoholic, budding alcoholic, what I hear is a free pass, you know, and you're not going to have to do anything and you get a free pass. And, you know, a lot of us in the room know that a high IQ or whatever they called it back then will get you a front row seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I mean, it won't do much to keep you sober, but I'm going through all this stuff, and you know, whatever happened in my growing up, I know a lot of it, it's funny, a lot of us get to AA and we try to figure out, why am I an alcoholic? You know, what happened to me to make me an alcoholic? None of that stuff made me an alcoholic. None of the stuff that happened to me growing up, none of the stuff that didn't happen to me growing up had to do with me being an alcoholic. And I like to talk about it. We hope to talk about it some this weekend. But I spent a lot of time in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, even raising my hand saying, my name's Charlie, I'm an alcoholic. And I had no idea what it meant. You know, I knew that I drank all the time, and I drank every day, and everybody, you know, my mother used to shake her finger at me and go, you drink, she had a way of moving just the finger, and she'd go, you drink every day. And I remember thinking, everybody I know drinks every day, Mom, you know, I mean, if, you know, and, well, I learned a lot more about that later, but I didn't really know what it meant to be alcoholic. I knew I had problems because of drinking. I'd been in a lot of trouble because of drinking. I'd lost the jobs and the cars and the girlfriends and that sort of thing. But that, some of that stuff, you know, happens to people that aren't alcoholic. And I mean, that happens to people that drink a lot. And so, you know, what is it? I mean, because I started drinking pretty young. And, you know, on page 30, it says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. It says it's the first step in recovery. Well, if I'm gonna, there's a lot going on in that sentence. That's what I love about the primary purpose group format, is that breaking it down and looking at what it really means. And when I say fully concede to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic, first of all, I best know what it means to be alcoholic if I'm gonna fully concede to it and not just up here in my head. What does it really mean to be alcoholic? You know, and I really didn't know. I started drinking when I was 16 years old. You know, it's funny. I'm 53 years old. I've been sober 25 years. Katie's got 5 months on me. She'll never let me live it down. Katie and I have quite a history. I hope to talk about that. The other thing I got to warn you, if we're going to be here all weekend, I got a little scatterbrain working up here, you know, and sometimes my brain is, we talked about ADHD on the way here with Ron, but whatever it is, sometimes when I say I'm going to get back to that later, that means this isn't the right time to talk about it in the talk. But when I tell you we're going to come back to it later, we're probably not coming back. You know? About a 5% chance we're going to pull it back around. I'm always so excited when I pull it back. But I used to think that 16 was really early to get started drinking, you know, and now it's not even young to stop. at 16. You know, I mean, you know, we got people coming in. You know, and I'm not busting on anybody. You know, much love for the young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't start drinking until I was 16, though, and I probably didn't need this program until I was about 17. You know, so I had a little while where it was going pretty good, and by 17 I was way into outside substances and outside issues. And Ron said this isn't officially an AA meeting, but I just my training is not to talk about outside issues in AA meetings. But let's just say I had deep experience with outside issues. You know? There was, to my knowledge, I didn't miss anything that was available when I was qualifying for this program. And it's funny, this isn't everybody's story in AA, and it'd be real macho to stand up here and say that I drank a fifth of whiskey from the time I was 16 until I sobered up at 28. That wouldn't be true. But what I can tell you, and this isn't true for everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of people held it together a lot better than I did, but for me, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded one time under any circumstances, under any conditions. Never one time. There was never one time where I went, oh, gee, thanks, but it's my mom's birthday or something like that. I didn't have it, you know, but I started somewhere around 17, 18 years old. I crossed some kind of an invisible line, and I don't know when it was. I think that's why we call it an invisible line, but, you know, I lost the power of choice and control somewhere around that age, and the book talks on page 44 about when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when you start drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. That's one of only really a couple of places in the book where it diagnoses alcoholism. But in the doctor's opinion, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Any argument on that one? You know, I mean, I've always felt like that was a little understated. You know, I like banana pudding, you know, but I loved the effect produced by alcohol. You know, I mean, I didn't just burn my whole world to the ground over something I just kind of dig a little bit. You know, I mean, it did something for me that I didn't even know I needed. It relieved a problem that I didn't even know I had. You know, and I've been carrying around a feeling of difference and separation and a little bit less than since about the fifth grade. And you know, that to me, that's as close as I've ever been able to come to describing the spiritual malady, is that feeling of separation, that hole that you hear so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about. But and when the first time I drank, it did something for that. And I remember thinking immediately, we are going to do this a lot. And I started paying a tremendous price for it, but I was kept trying to make it work like it did when I was 18, 19 years old, you know. And I mean, it started getting, you know, you go for a long time and it's good, and then you start having it's pretty good, but some negative stuff, and then lots of negative stuff, and then it's just kind of all negative towards the end. But in my delusional mind, I'm still thinking that one day it's going to be like it was when I was 18, 19 years old again, you know, and I had that mix where it was just right. And I would always overshoot the mark a little bit, you know, and wreck the car and stuff. You know, and AA was the first place I'd ever been around people that drank like I drank and understood what drinking did for me. Because when my mother would say, you know, you drink too much, I wouldn't have even been able to formulate it in words, but I would have said, you know, look, Mom, I can see from where you're sitting, it probably looks like I drank a lot, you know, and maybe I do, you know, and sometimes I overshoot the mark and I wreck the car and I lose the girlfriend or I get thrown in jail or I spend the whole paycheck or something like that. But if you understood what drinking does for me, you wouldn't be saying stupid crap to me like, like you need to stop drinking, because at some level I knew drinking, you know, was my solution. You know, it looked like my problem, but it was what I was using to treat my problem. It started getting really sloppy there for a while. I one night I left a bar in a blackout, and I'd had five Long Island teas, and Is that a universal drink? Long Island. Okay. Well, that's a lot. There was a crash, and I could see a fender sticking up. My field of vision was only about this big. I could see a fender sticking up, and we're still rolling. So I've kept my foot on the gas, and I drove around the corner and jumped out, grabbed my shoes, and I'm running back to the bar to report the car stolen. And, obviously there's been a car theft. And this is not an extraordinary night. You know, this is just Charlie rolling, you know. So I call it in, and the next morning they call me and they go, Mr. Parker, you're going to have to come take a polygraph test before you get your car back. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, it was involved in an accident before. I forgot this piece of the story. As I'm running back to the bar with my shoes in my hand, across the street are two cops standing out there in the street. And I can remember their flashlight tinkling off all this glass that's in the street. And in my altered state, I still remember thinking, my God, they got here fast. You know, I mean, how did they get here so fast? And when they called me and said, you're going to have to take a polygraph test, I said, why? And they said, well, it was in an accident before it was reported stolen. I said, really? And they said, yeah, they ran into a parked police car. And I remember thinking, that explains how they got there so fast, you know, because I'd been a little foggy on you know, how they, I mean, they were there like that, you know, but I mean, Norm Alpe used to talk about how our lives were saved and changed by seconds and inches, and I had a lot of stories like that where my, you know, the Canadian border could have said, oh, hell no. You know, I mean, if they'd have seen the record of what I should have been arrested for, because it was like that all the time. I mean, it was just, you know, getting out of a deal. And if those two cops had been standing there when I rolled down the street, you know, I could still be in jail, you know, for running over a couple of cops. But, you know, I started losing the power of choice and control. Somewhere along the line, I could choose whether or not I was going to get loaded. And I couldn't control how much I was going to drink when I started drinking. Now we're getting into the definition of alcoholism. You know, turns out there's two things that make me alcoholic. One is what happens to me when I drink it, and one is what happens to me when I don't drink it. And other than that, I got a pretty good handle on drinking. But the thing that happens to me when I drink it is it triggers that phenomenon of craving. When I take a drink, I can't guarantee when I'm going to stop or how it's going to go with any predictability. And then it goes on further, you know, to say, and the book talks a whole lot about that. The first 23 pages of the book and most of the doctor's opinion talks about that physical craving that triggers. But then it says that wouldn't mean anything if I didn't ever take the first drink. And that's that second part, is that I get so miserable when I'm not drinking that I'm going to drink again. And, you know, so when we talk about recovering from a hopeless condition of mind and body, the way that rolls out when it gets fully developed in a guy like me is I'm so uncomfortable when I stay sober or when I try to. My problem wasn't that I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop starting. You know, every time I'd stop drinking, I'd eventually start drinking again. And the weird thing about it, that thing about that phenomenon of craving, every time I ever took that first drink that triggered that phenomenon of craving, I was stone cold sober. That's kind of one of the baffling parts of alcoholism is I make the craziest decision in my life, the decision to take another run at it, even though I have zero evidence to prove that this is going to go well. I make that decision stone cold sober because I get so uncomfortable not drinking. You know, so when you get stuck in that cycle, the book calls it the terrible cycle. And the way it rolls out for a guy like me is once it's fully developed in a guy like me, I'm going to drink until I have to stop. And then I'm going to stop until I have to drink. And that's the terrible cycle that the book talks about. And it goes down. So for the new guys in the room, if you don't take anything away other than what it means to be an alcoholic and the nature of alcoholism, that is huge. Because when that's fully established in a guy like me, my first job in step one when I'm working with a new guy, and we'll talk about this a lot tomorrow, is to give this guy a fatal dose of alcoholism. I need to understand in here that on my own power, I got no shot, period. Absolutely no shot. So, but when I talk about the power of choice and control, I like to talk about the pawn shops because I loved pawn shops. I mean, I loved the whole theory, the whole equation of it was just so pure, you would walk in there and say, here's my shotgun. Well, I should also say that another big key to this is that, well, I'll get to that in just a second, but you never walk in there and hand them the shotgun and they go, good God, man, what are you going to do with this money? Weren't you just here this morning or, something like that? It never happens. You hand them the deer rifle and they give you the money and out you go. And then you come back with the coin collection and the only problem with this equation, and you had 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop, before they sold it. The only one problem with this equation, I should say, is that I didn't own very much stuff. So I was always pawning stuff that didn't belong to me. And Katie thinks it's an important part of the police car story to say that it was my mother's car that I wrecked. I wrecked every car my mother ever owned. And, I was so poorly treated as a child growing up that I finally ran away from home for good at the age of 27. I'm not kidding. Never went back. I had some apartments in there, but I'd always wind up back on their couch, and I was real hard on my folks. And so there's a lot of their stuff that I'm pawning. And, when we talk about the loss of choice and control, are there any Al-Anons here? Okay. All right. Well, I want to say in advance, there's parts of this story that we know aren't funny. Some of it I have to tell it like it's a joke. The level of powerlessness that we walk around with is devastating. And I didn't know when I got here why, when I would promise people that I'm not going to do this anymore, I'd keep doing it, So with this pawn shop thing, drunks make good plans. We make just brilliant plans. And they work right up till they don't work anymore, and the plan with this was I had 3 months to get everything out of the pawn shop, and then you could kind of roll again, and I could usually pull a scam every 3 months to get everything, except for this one night I got an insurance claim and I just stopped in for a couple of drinks. I didn't know that by stopping in there I was triggering a phenomenon of craving and that I had no control over what was about to happen. But what happened was, I was a blackout drinker, a lot. Katie wasn't, I was. But this was a 5-day blackout. 5 days, don't remember anything except for one incident where a friend of mine got cut. Other than that, I don't remember anything in the rest of that 5 days. And I came out of this blackout and I had $8 and all those pawn tickets. And, those mornings where you just go, oh no, if you're an alcoholic and you're sitting in this room, those mornings, where you just go, I shot my wad, I put everything I had into getting that other little scam and now I've blown the money and what are we going to do now? And I would have to go to my father and say, Dad, if we act now, this is the part that I said we know isn't funny. I'd say, if we act now, I can get you a really good deal on all your stuff. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail, So the point of this story is, when we talk about the loss of choice and control, this was in Dallas, Texas. I grew up in Dallas. I live in Austin, Texas now. And we would get in the car, and it wasn't like you're just going to go to the pawn shop. It was, we had to get in the car. And Dallas is a big, sprawling, spread-out city, not an urban, vertical-type city. It's like L.A. in that it's real wide and low. And So it wasn't like we're just going to go to the pawn shop. It was like we got to go around Garland Road and get your deer rifle, and we got to go to Buckner Boulevard and get the shotgun, and then your coin collection's out on East Grand, and then the metal detectors are on Beltline Road, and the sterling silver's over in Oak Cliff, and we got to go to Garland. So it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all this shame. You know, just it's all over you, you know. And I mean, I knew enough to know that this wasn't right. My dad was a good man. Nobody was giving him his stuff. And here I am, you know, out there pawning it. The reason this story is important about loss of choice and control is because when we would be riding in that car, I would be saying, Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again. And if I was lying to that guy, I damn sure didn't know it. Because it felt like I meant it with every fiber of my being that I will never, ever do this again. I'll never put you through this again. I don't ever want to be like this again. What I didn't know was that I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. But telling him I wasn't going to do this again, I might as well have been promising him that I was going to flap my arms and fly up around the back of the room and come back and land at this podium, because I did not have the power to make good on that promise. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the loss of choice and control. If you're a person that can make up your mind to stop drinking and pull it off, you don't even belong in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is for people like me that swear to God, this time I mean business, and I drink again. Because within 2 or 3 days, I'd hit the back door of his house like a cat burglar, and it'd be off and again. And my dad and I made the rounds of the pawn shops 3 times before I eventually sobered up. Well, okay, I still got a little time. That's what we're talking about when we talk about, you know, the loss of choice and control and a hopeless condition of mind and body, is that I get so uncomfortable when I try to stay sober that I'm going to drink again eventually. Restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, the doctor's opinion that does a brilliant job of laying this stuff out in the first 43 pages of the big book, and the doctor's opinion are pretty much devoted to step one, because we're not going anywhere until I got that in here. Not up here, but in here where I go, my God, what if I am a garden variety alcoholic? What if I, you know, the way you're describing this stuff is explaining a lot of stuff that I've never been able to explain before. You know, like when people would say, why'd you start drinking again? I gave them the only answer any of us have, which is what? I don't know. That's what I do, you know? And, now I know. But, I mean, I tell you, it still doesn't make your family feel a lot better. You know, if they go, why'd you start drinking? You go, well, it's like this, Mom. I have a spiritual malady. And it's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. You know, and it creates a mental obsession in me that makes me powerless over the first drink. And when I take the first drink, that makes me powerless over the second. And Mom, I actually have a hopeless condition of mind and body. And, you know, that's why I pawned your television set. But it damn sure helped me to know it, you know, because until we have this common problem, we're not going to be interested in the common solution. And we all get here a little unique. A lot of us as newcomers, I used to think that I could break this deal down for the new guy and we'd all get it and lock elbows and trudge the road of happy destiny together. I forgot that most of us are sitting there going, I don't have it like that. I don't have it like you've got it. If I had it like you've got it, I'd work your stupid little 12-step thing or whatever it is. But, I mean, I think when I get out of here, I can still tweak this deal a little bit and make it work. You know, I know it looks bad right now because I'm in detox and stuff, but I really, you know, it's not as bad as it looks. I got this, you know, and that's what we will ride into the graveyard. The book talks about, you know, it's present in us a long time before most of us suspect it. But there's something that happens on that day when I have that, what we call a step one experience, where all of a sudden I go, hold on just a minute. what you're saying is explaining a lot of stuff I've never been. Because Clancy likes to say, if you gave every one of us a flag to wave when we're coming new, all of our flags would say the same thing. It'd say, you don't understand. My case is different. You know? But there's something that happens when all of a sudden I go, what if I'm just a garden variety alcoholic? You know, then the common solution becomes available to me and we can get something done. You know, when we're doing the steps and stuff tomorrow, we're going to break it down into the problem, the solution, and the program of action. They're three critical things, but that, you know, I'm not going to be interested in the solution to a problem I don't think I have. Does that make sense? It'd be like going to PTA meetings when I don't have any children. You know, it's just, why would I do that? You know, but the moment that I really think I'm one of y'all, this deal gets really interesting. You know, there's a friend of mine likes to say that I know two things about AA that I didn't know when I got here, and that is that I was in a lot more trouble than I thought I was when I got here. And the other is that AA had a lot bigger answer than I was giving them credit for. You know, I really thought I had a little bit of a problem and that maybe we could just tweak things just a little bit and it'd be all right. But AA's got a big answer for a huge problem. And, you know, one of the things I hope we get around to talking about, you know, is that my first pass in AA, I didn't understand the problem. I really thought the problem was alcohol. And I went through a sponsor, with the sponsor, and we went through the steps, and I mean, it's funny, when I read the book, I like to look for things that I agree with. Anybody, I guess I'm the only one like that, right? You know, I like to read and look for things that I already agree about, you know, and that's why we work so much with the set-aside prayer, because sometimes I'll just say, help me set aside everything I think I know about this stuff, and let me see the truth, because otherwise I'll sit there and I go, oh yeah, oh yeah, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, oh yeah. I got that underlined and highlighted. You know, you can't. You know. But when I do the little set aside prayer, all of a sudden stuff starts showing up, and I can see things. You know, outside of what I already. Otherwise, I'm just looking for stuff that I already agree with. You know, I'm looking for evidence that I'm already right. You know, and I can't. We're not going anywhere like that. But I've got a few minutes left to say. I spent quite a few years in AA acting like the problem was alcohol. I didn't know it. I didn't know that I was in fellowship-based Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that I was middle of the road. I didn't know that I was, had a misunderstanding of the steps. You know, what I spent a good deal of time in untreated alcoholism and didn't know it. And it's funny, I have a problem sometimes with judging people really harshly for not knowing something that I learned about 30 minutes ago. Yeah. I know that happens in Texas. I'm sure it doesn't happen in Canada, but you know, I'll get a new understanding of this stuff. And next thing you know, I'm going, did you hear him in the meeting for God's sakes? You know, I mean, he's killing newcomers, you know, but I mean, I spent a lot of time in this stuff and my first pass through the steps, I really thought that the problem was alcohol, and that God's going to help me with it. I wasn't really down with God, but then when I did an inventory. You know, one of the big problems that I see, and we'll talk about this a lot more tomorrow, is if taking a guy right from "Are you willing to believe" to getting him on his knees and doing a third step prayer. And I had no idea what that huge body of work that takes place on pages 60 to 63. There's no way I'm going to have time to talk about this tonight. We'll try to talk about it tomorrow. But just to fast forward, it turned, you know, and when I had a plane crash in 2003 where we crashed into the water at night and out on Eastern Long Island and had to escape from an underwater plane, and we're on CNN and everything, and it was very dramatic. I mean, there's no Earl Hightower story, but it was pretty darn dramatic, you know. And I started looking at things a lot differently, and I realized that at 17 years of sobriety, I was so self-centered that I couldn't even really be involved in a conversation with anybody. Because I didn't care, you know. I would have to force myself to go, how are the kids, you know, and act like I give a flip about the answer, you know, because I got me on me like that, you know, and so when I'm reading the book, and I come across that line now where it says the first, in step three, where it says, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I was like, where did that come from? I mean, because not only was I not convinced of that, that line had never touched me. I mean, when I talk about this huge, the book takes a huge right turn on page 60. And I missed it for a long, long time in the fellowship as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what the real problem was. So when it talks about selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our problem. Above everything, we got to get rid of the selfishness. I mean, it's, you know, that's where Mark Houston just lit us on fire. And I really wish he could be here this weekend to talk to you all about it. But I mean, this level of, you know, seeing now that the problem never really was alcohol, that alcohol was what I found that would soothe the pain of a life based completely on self-centeredness. And it always reminds me, and I'll try to close with it, but I'm a Dallas Cowboy fan. I'm sure. All right. I can't believe that. I didn't expect that. But I spent 20 years going to Dallas Cowboys games and sitting, you know, and I've loved them since I was a kid, since they were good, you know, we've died 1,000 deaths since Troy Aikman retired. But, you know, I'd always go to these Cowboy games. And then a couple of years ago, I had this sponsee that says, hey, you know, he goes, my family's got a skybox at Texas Stadium. He goes, you want to go watch the Philadelphia game in the skybox? I went, absolutely. And we go, we drive up there and we park in this a little private parking lot, and we go in through this private entrance, and you go up this civilized little escalator, and you go into a civilized little hallway, and it's all real quiet, and you know, you go into the room and they're bringing buckets of ice and trays of cookies and stuff. And I didn't know whether to be excited about being in a skybox or be pissed about sitting in the cheap seats for 20 years. But that's the way my experience was with Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent 17 years in AA thinking I was doing AA. And I find out later that there's people doing it at a whole nother level that I'd never even dreamed of, you know. And so, I mean, that's what we get so excited about coming and talking about. I had no idea. If I'd have died in that plane crash on July 20th of 2003, I would have missed it. I almost missed it anyway. If you'd have come to me at 17 years of sobriety and said, Charlie, what is going to change your life and set you on fire is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous right out of the big book, I would have told you were crazy, because I'd been in AA for a long time. I thought I knew what AA had to offer me. You know, so the experience that we've had over the past 7 or 8 years, my God, I mean, I had no idea it was there. And, you know, now, you know, Katie will try to talk about it. She's a lot more centered and focused than I am. But you know, she sponsors about 25 girls. I'm sponsoring about 15 guys. We're going out to she goes to the women's treatment. I go to the men's treatment center. She has a Monday night meeting at the house with her girls. I have a Thursday night meeting at the house with my guys that Mark Houston came to every Thursday night for 4 years. I mean, there was never one time where he walked in that house and I took it for granted. Every time he'd walk in there, I knew this is really awesome, you know, to have Mark coming into the house every Thursday night. And the best AA I've ever been involved in was sitting at that kitchen table with 10 or 12 of us, you know, sitting there talking about AA, you know, the depth and the level of the understanding of the book. And, you know, it's just like, the first time I was ever around Mark, it's just like, what book is he reading from? You know, I mean, I'm seeing stuff that it sounds like it's coming from a book I've never read before. So, I'm real excited to be here. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I'm real anxious to say it. I've actually just ran right from the car to the podium. So I'm really looking forward to sitting down here and what Katie's got to say. Katie and I were, we have a very interesting history. We were litter mates in AA. We both came in at the same time, and we were like brother and sister for 20 years. She was like my kid sister, and she was married the whole time, and her husband passed away, and we became a couple about 7 years ago. We've been married less than 9 months, but she's the best thing that's ever happened to me, and she really works a rock-solid AA program, and I'm looking forward to hearing her talk, and we're real happy to be here. Thanks for listening. Yeah.
I'm Katie. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Amen.
I've had the gift of sobriety since October the 28th of 1984. For that, I'm very grateful. That is 5 months more than my husband. And, you know, one of the important things about that is that, you know, sometimes when he's not getting it, I always tell him it'll make more sense in about 5 months. So. It is such an honor to be here, and I want to thank everybody for inviting us. I know it was supposed to be Mark that was here, but I got to tell you, in the 4 years that I knew Mark Houston and absolutely loved the man, he absolutely changed Charlie and I's life. He would want us to be here. If he could have said, you know what, Chris, I had no intentions of dying, but since I did, bring Katie and Charlie. I do know he'd say that. He absolutely loved us, and we loved him. And we always were trying to make Mark a social butterfly. If you knew Mark very well, he wasn't a social butterfly. And Charlie and I were determined to get him in the parade. And he's a wonderful man. But I am very honored to be here with Chris and with my husband. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous with all my heart. You are my people. I feel at home in anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous is where I feel at home. And one of the things is, guys, you know, the book does say, you know, for me to tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. I always feel like that means what I was like without God in my life, what happened and what I'm like now. I don't tell a lot of my drunk story, mainly because I there's a lot of humor in alcoholics' drunk stories, but I don't know that there's a lot of knowledge. Your story's the same as my story. I couldn't stop drinking. I know incomprehensible demoralization. Once I start drinking, I don't stop. And I love these weekends that have the big book involved because we can get into the meat of the work in that. But I do like to talk about what I was like as a kid, because if I believe that alcoholism has everything to do with me and very little to do with booze, if booze was the is merely a symptom, I don't want to tell you how I drank. I drank like you drank. I drank till I got drunk, till I couldn't remember. Although mine were brownouts is what Charlie and I realized. We had a long discussion on what do you consider a blackout. Only drunks would have that. And he goes, so you never blacked out? It's like, no. I go, I mean, the next day you had to kind of remind me of some stuff, but it came to me pretty quickly. You know, I mean, I did wake up and think, how'd I get here? And then I came through to it pretty quickly. But I didn't ever go, you know, sometimes I hear drunk stories where, you know, they went 3 days in a blackout. That was not my experience. Never was my experience. As a matter of fact, if you want to look at me as a kid, you take this same kid and you pour booze into me and you watch the difference in personality. Where the book talks about being driven by 100 forms of fear, I was so driven in life. That sense of entitlement was what, it was like my shield is I'm going to get it. I deserve it. Nobody else does. I better be the first one to do everything. And so that's what I like to talk more about, because when you take away the booze, man, there's that same personality still there. I was born in 1958. I'm 52 years old. I've got a beautiful 31-year-old daughter, 21-year-old son, 3.5-year-old grandson. Let's just have a moment for that. We just went to Toy Story 3. Oh, God dang. Yeah, see, you know, I mean, I don't take sobriety for granted at all. I mean, I walk in there thinking, this would never have happened. 25 years sober, this would never have happened if I were still drinking. Never. Not a chance. My kids would never trust me with their children. And so I was third born, and I don't know about you guys, but if you're the baby of the family, you were tortured. Yes. Let's hear it for the third borns. Come on. Come on. I do not want to hear it for the firstborn. No, boo, boo. And the third born child, right, is the tortured one, or at least I was tortured. My brother and sister loved me dearly, but the truth of the matter is, you know, I was always kind of like, let Mikey try it. You know, let Katie try it. Let Katie try it. There's no baby pictures of me. There's no memories of Katie. By the time the third one comes around, mom's tired, dad's tired. Okay, yeah, yeah, she's around here somewhere. And so I figured out real quick that I wanted to be noticed, and I was going to jump on out there in life, right? There's two things. When I look back and I look at alcoholism, you know, you have those memories where you think, wow, that happened, and wow, that happened. You know, you don't think those things when you're drinking, but when you get sober and you start waking up to this deal, a lot of things come kind of eye-opener for you. And there was two things that I look back at today. I clearly did not like the way I felt. There was something wrong, but I couldn't have identified what it was. I couldn't have identified it for many, many years, but I loved to hyperventilate. Did anybody else like to hyperventilate? Oh my God. And see, you're proud of it too, aren't you? Get me that close to death and I dig it. And what we used to do as kids, long before booze, long before dope, you wrap that towel up tight, you strangle somebody and they, you go straight out, right? And when you come to, I don't know about you, but I couldn't wait to do it again. There was that euphoric come to moment where it's like, oh, dude, do it again, do it again, do it again. And then there were the kids that came out of that and went, don't you ever touch me again, you know. And that could have been a good test for alcoholism. I really think that that right there, that group's alcoholic, that ain't. And I loved hyperventilating and I loved Vicks Formula 44. And I was a sick kid, and I drank that stuff like crazy, that black stuff. And I would never have thought anything of it. It was just the way it was until I got sober and woke up way into sobriety and started thinking, wow, I wanted to change the way I felt long before I found the booze. I just never felt like I fit in. So I had to overachieve in everything. Now, the book talks about self-manifested in various ways is what caused our failure, right? If we're all in this same understanding that booze is not the problem. Now, booze will kill you. It doggone sure will. And I'll end up drinking and dying. That's a very big problem. But if booze is my problem, then why am I crazy in sobriety? Because it ain't the booze. The booze will end up killing me. Or I'll kill myself. See, I'll get so restless, irritable, and discontented, I'll end it. I got to figure out how to end it pretty fun, but I'll end it, right? And so when we talk about this level of self-manifesting in various ways, it's how does self show up? I mean, the person who sits there quietly and drinks at home and the person who's got a drink outside in the club, you know, their personalities may be very different. It's just how they're manifesting. Doesn't mean that there's any difference in the allergy and the mental obsession, right? We got to get down to those causes and conditions and really unfold all that. Well, my old ideas are getting ready to be pretty obvious to you. As a kid, I'm third born, I'm driven. I am driven to be noticed in the world, right? And that kid is the pain in the ass. How many of y'all have given birth to that child? Oh, yeah. I mean, you know that one kid, the kid where you go, my God, this kid's going to drive me crazy. Well, that was me. I mean, I was that kid. But we're tooling along in life, and, you know, my dad's a booze in my household was fun, 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 fun. I mean, my dad was an ex-football player, ex-professional football player, played for the Steelers. He was a party boy. When we had alcohol, it was always around parties that he and my mother had. And we had the entire Buffalo Bills team over one time. And I mean, alcohol represented fun. I don't know if you guys experienced that, but in AA, you hear a lot of tragedy. You know, booze and dad beat mom. And man, that was not my experience. Alcohol always equaled fun. And so I just saw it as an enhancement, you know, that's what it was. I tried my first drink around 11, started drinking heavier at 12, right? I mean, you had the open bar at home. And, but around 9 years old, actually I was at eight, and my mother got sick. And the next thing you know, it's back in the 60s, 1966, for you guys that were around, you know, there was a, in the hospitals, you weren't, kids weren't allowed in the hospitals. There was three channels on TV. There was no internet, no cellular phones. Your bicycle didn't even have a seat. Are y'all with me on that? Yeah. You're riding around with that tube sticking straight, that pipe sticking straight up. And, I mean, you know, swimming in the dark brown bio water. I mean, am I talking to the right group of people? You dive in. You don't know where the bottom is. You don't know where the snakes are. You're just pulling through and coming out with twigs all in your hair. And, you know, we just had a ball growing up. But the truth is that it was a different day and age back then. And my mom got real sick. And I remember my dad saying, we need to go see her. She's in the hospital. And, I mean, it was like overnight. Now I find out she'd been sick for some time. Well, long story short, they take us into the hospital. And once again, kids weren't allowed in the hospitals and, you know, childhood illnesses and all of that. And it was very eerie and very weird. And, you know, everybody's whispering. And I these are moments I remember clearly. And we walked in the room. She was a small woman. And I remember thinking, I want out of here. I don't have any recollection of how bad it was for my mother. Anything like that. I want it out. Don't like this feeling. Get me out of here. Now, most people would say, you know, well, that's a kid. That's not my sister's experience. My sister's experience was very much on how she could help my mother. What's wrong? What can we do for mom? I want it out. See, that's the root of my problem. All I ever think about is how this affects me. And man, I'm telling you what, that stuff comes just behind me like a wave all the time, especially when I look back at it in life. I mean, that level of self-centeredness, when the book says self will run riot, there's a comma, though he usually doesn't think so. I mean, I've never been in a riot. I've seen them on TV. I've watched a fist fight from the sidelines, right? You feel pretty protected. Nobody's going to be throwing a punch at you. Two people, but a riot, man, you don't know where the bullets are coming from. You don't know where the glass is coming from. And it tells me that that's my life, and I usually don't think so. See, I'm so self-consumed, and the more and more I'm awakened to my level of self-centeredness, the freer I get. It's just a matter of what I am, right? One time, my buddy Bob D said something that I thought was so cool. He said, you know, when life is good for the alcoholic, if they're not working an AA program, they'll drift just like the person where life isn't good, right? Doesn't matter if it's good or bad. I'm going to get restless, irritable, and discontent no matter what if I'm not working those 12 steps. And he said, if you were diabetic and you were going into a diabetic coma and you got rushed to the hospital, they wouldn't go, I don't understand what's happening to him, man. He's got a nice car and a beautiful home. I mean, does that make sense? It's unbelievable. And that's how I am. So the next day, my dad comes up to my sister and I's bedroom and, you know, my brother. That was back when the kids slept in, you know, one room. They all got to have their own room now, don't they? Their own room, their own car, their own bike. Don't even get me started on that. My mother had passed away. And I was 9, my sister was 10, my brother was 12. We went through a series of housekeepers. My father was a traveling salesman for Union Carbide after he played ball. And we went through a series of live-in housekeepers and mothers. In 6 weeks, he had a woman moved in. And that's pretty quick, right? And now, once again, when you look back, you start going, whoa. So my dad had a woman moved in. She lasted for the weekend, and she was gone. She had two kids with her. I do recall that. And I recall hating the youngest one for taking my role. You know what I mean? I considered pushing her in a pool that had no water. Am I in the right room of people here? Okay. Yeah, that is not normal. Okay. Within about 3 months, there was another woman that came in. And she lasted about, I think she lasted somewhere from 3 weeks to 3 months. It's all a little blurry to me. another couple of live-in housekeepers, and then he married another one. So my dad married three women in 18 months, and we had six live-in housekeepers. Now, you know what that did? Is that gave me a tremendous amount of old ideas. You know, the book says old ideas we had to let go absolutely. That's what they are. See, when I grow up, I got all this stuff I looked at life and all these opinions I took, judgments I took, beliefs I made, call them whatever you want to. The book calls them old ideas and prejudice. And so I went through life with these old ideas and they're driving me. I mean, they drove me crazy. I was a huge cheater in school. I learned early on that I didn't get whatever the teacher was saying. Did any of you guys miss formal education? Anybody? I mean, I missed it. I'd be listening and going, I'm not getting it. And then one time I noticed in school, everybody's taking notes and I'm not. And then I'm taking notes and nobody else is. It was like, oh my God, do I just pick up on the shit that doesn't matter? I mean, what is wrong with me? You know, and I mean, so I learned early on in life that I was going to have to cheat. And I mean to tell you, I became an incredible cheater. Oh, God dang. And I'm not talking mildly looking over to somebody's paper. I'm talking in the fifth grade, leaving the building unlocked, the window so I could crawl in, knowing where the janitor started cleaning so that I could, you know, change the grades. And remember, back then, all you needed was a number two pencil. You did not need anybody's computer passcode. Number two pencil. I'm in. Bingo. I even got so creative because back then, you know, we were doing a tremendous amount of outside issues. They were easier to get than booze, at least for me. Outside issues, there was so much dope in Houston, Texas, that you could just get dope everywhere. I mean, and I did love that you said we could talk about dope. I did so much LSD. And they said your brain cells would not rejuvenate. Yes, they will. I'm just telling you, they do. And I loved LSD. But so, you know, we could get all the dope we wanted, but when you're a kid, you can't really get the booze too easily, right? And so the way we got booze was we'd sit in front of that 7-Eleven, and we'd wait for that creepy guy to pull up. I always loved to look at the girls. They always go, oh. And you wait for the creepy guy, right? And the creepy guy pulls up, and you ask him if he can buy booze, and he's like, oh, yeah. You know, and you're like 14, which really makes this guy a pervert. And I know that creepy guy's in here, aren't you? Go ahead. Uh-huh. Let's have a moment for the creepy guy. But so, you know, you're 14, you don't have a car. So you got to lose creepy guy pretty quickly. And so, you know, you're bobbing and weaving because he wants to hang with you. You know, he's got the booze and he sees the young girls, you know, so we're bobbing and weaving through the woods and we usually lose him pretty quick. But so, you know, I'm a cheater in school. I mean, I'm telling you guys, I'm talking cheating. I'm talking breaking into briefcases, getting essay papers, you know. And here's the deal. When the book talks about driven by 100 forms of fear, right before it, it says selfish and self-centered, that we think is the root of our trouble, right? And what that means is self-consumed. If you can't wrap your brain around those two words and you say, well, I'm not selfish. I mean, I'll share my booze with you. I'll share my dope with you. I mean, I'm not self-centered. I don't just talk about me. I'm not stingy and conceited. I'm self-consumed. All I ever think about is Katie. And so when you're this self-consumed, you're driven by 100 forms of fear. The book could have said 1,000 forms of fear. Fear is not the root of my problem. It's what drives me. And see, for me, dropping out of school was absolutely not going to happen because that would label me a loser. And I am not a loser. I am okay. And I'll show you. So I'm not kidding you guys. I got no education. Now I can read. I don't comprehend well. I can read. I own my own business. I'm incredibly successful in life. But I'm telling you, I was sitting at a pretty fancy dinner party one time and somebody said, I hope I get this right, honey. I screw this stuff up so bad. What is San Juan, the capital of Puerto Rico? Somebody said, what is the capital of Puerto Rico? And I swear, I'm like, and they look right at me and I'm thinking, I don't even know where Puerto Rico is, man. You know, and I go, Oh, it's, I said, you know, it's on the tip of my tongue. I just, give me a minute. Give me a minute. Because that's how, yeah, it's, nobody needs to know. I've got no education. Because for some reason, the world likes to judge the, you know, the people with no education. I've got no formal education. Now, I don't know about you guys, but y'all that don't have much education, when you came into AA and they handed you a book, was that a bad idea? Oh, my God. I went, you got a book? You got it like on CD or anything like that? Any tape, man? God dang. And then I'm reading Bill's story and it sounded like I was talking to my great, great grandfather. You know, oh my God. And I don't know about you, but the first time I read The Jaywalker, I went, what? And I just thought, oh, I can't, I'm not getting it. I am not getting it. But, and so that's what I'm talking about, though. I'm driven. So I leave home when I'm 15, right? My father and I are just bucking heads. Boy, we are just battling it out. I don't like rules. That level of sense of entitlement is unbelievable. Charlie and I are trying to get on the plane this morning. For some reason, they lost his reservation. And he normally is the one who does all the standing at the counter thing. I have learned in life to step back. And after losing my husband, long story there, but... And this woman was not answering him. Then he'd ask her a question. And he'd ask her a question, and I thought, I'm just going to reach over there and slap the shit out of her in a minute. I mean, I thought, I'm not going to Canada. I am not just, whoop-ah! You know, and I thought, oh, my God. I mean... To walk me off the ledge from that moment, are you with me on that? I mean, I down flicker, you know. When it says pause when agitated, if you're not working an active AA program, that's a crapshoot. You know what I mean? And thank God I'm working an active AA program, but. Okay, so you've got an idea. So this influenced my old ideas. Left home at 15, still finished school. I was most popular. I had to be everything. And I'd like for you to think I am the most popular of the two boys, if there's any sort of voting that's going on at the end of this deal. This is Katie driven. Okay. When I found that booze, that is the only thing that gave me this. Booze and dope, man. Oh, my God. So by the time I overshot the mark, right? And we all know what that looks like. I ended up having a child when I was 21 and, you know, trying not to drink and do drugs when you're pregnant. You boys don't know what you're missing there. You know, all of a sudden you talk about guilt, shame, and remorse. You try not to be, you know, doing tons of dope and tons of drinking when you know you're growing a baby. It's tough. And I didn't do it. You know, I tried to do the best I could, but when we walk that all the way down, it gets so ugly. And what I ended up realizing is this has gotten out of hand. This drinking and drugging is out of hand, man. I have got to stop. And that's the program I led. I did a program based on the abstinence of drugs and alcohol. I really, really thought, take that away and I got it from here, man. I stumbled into AA, met a boy, got married, loved him to death. We were married for 20 years. Go figure, huh? Most people, he had 6 years. I had 10 minutes. That's a good match. The whole AA, you know, home group is like, oh, let's watch this one unveil. Oh, it was a ride, people, it was a ride. But, you know, I'm a year sober, and Charlie, Joe and I are just inseparable, right? And I love him to death. He knows the big book, and he reads me the big book. I mean, how romantic is that? Because I don't read very well. I mean, I read okay, I don't comprehend. And so we're sitting in an AA meeting, and I got about a year sober. Joe has 7 now, and Charlie walks in and shares, and God dang, he's so damn funny. And I leaned over to Joe and I said, oh my God, we have got to get to know this guy. And you know, I'm 26, Charlie's 28, Joe's 30, and we're litter mates. And you know how that is. I mean, you guys know when you get sober, you got your people and you got your litter mates, and we're litter mates and we're inseparable, right? We're doing, you know, come over to Charlie's house and we barbecue every night. We watch Miami Vice, if that's dating me at all. Joe and I's wedding was a Miami Vice wedding. Oh, yeah. And, but we just loved Charlie, and Charlie loved us, and we all grew up together, you know, and that's like I tell you, that's the fellowship I crave. And Joe and I are tooling along, and we're pretty secure in AA. We're the couple that made it, right? Charlie would come over. Favela was another one of our buddies. He'd come over, and what ended up happening, guys, was at about 3 years, and listen to the dates because I think they're crucial. Charlie, I like to say how we are at 5 years and at 10 years and at 15 years. Charlie doesn't like it, so I'm going to honor that he doesn't like it and won't say it. May come out this weekend, but he told me that in the pool, and I thought, shut up. But I believe, okay, at 3 years, I don't believe the new guy gets the self piece. I just don't believe you get it. I believe you're asleep to the self piece. So you are living a life based on the abstinence of alcohol, right? And you're getting your life back together, and all of a sudden, man, you got the job and you got the car and you got the family, and everybody's back together, and you're just, you know, marching through life, and you become, or at least for me, I became the victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I just managed well. I was managing my ass off, and I was a nice person. I'd let you in the line. Come on. You need it? Yeah. You need me to help you get with that? I'll help you get with that because I'm a nice person. Right? And that's what I thought that whole piece meant. Well, Joe says to me, Katie, I want to go back to church. And he always liked the Bible a lot. And I thought, you know, I just didn't dig it. I didn't have a bad taste in my mouth. I just didn't dig it. I was raised Catholic, and they were still doing the Latin thing. And I said, I'll tell you what, you go to church, and if you really dig it, I'll go to church. And so he came home. He goes, I really like it, Katie, man. They got a big old screen. It's non-denominational. It's young people. It's really happening. Okay, I'll give it a shot. So I go in there, you know, and I mean, we are singing and doing the hand waving thing. And I'd never done anything like that before. And I thought, I'm digging it, man. I'm liking it. And the next thing you know, we walk away from AA. 3 years, just kind of walk away. Now I got 3 years and he now has 9. We walk away from AA. Just kind of making meetings, still keeping our fellowship, right? This is how cunning, baffling, and powerful the disease of alcoholism is. He was a huge big book thumper. Huge. I mean, it's just shocking. So we get into church and we kind of decide that the book says we need to, it says on page 14, it says imperative to work with others. How appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, for some reason I put a period there. It says, through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. So it's telling me I need to work with others. Well, I'm thinking I need to go to church to find this spirituality. Now, don't hear me wrong, and don't hear what I'm not saying, for God's sakes. But what I did is I came to church and found Jesus. I don't know if you've ever found that, but I found Jesus. Are you with me? Now, if you're from Texas, you'd know what I mean. I found Jesus. And that is a very dangerous place for somebody who is not working a 12-step program, and now they have found Jesus. Because what ended up happening is I needed to come back and save you people. Because it was Jesus that you were missing. Oh, my God, you guys. Somebody armed with just Jesus that's alcoholic and no 12 steps is a dangerous person. There is a great balance between the two, yes? You can have all the church you want. As a matter of fact, we encourage some sort of spiritual denomination of your choice. And Alcoholics Anonymous. But not just that. Otherwise, we just need to go to church, right, to find that spirituality. Well, I got so crazy behind Jesus that, there's a picture of Joe and I. We look Amish. Because, you know, we are chameleons, you know. We'll just go in and fit in and do whatever we need to do, you know. And so, oh, And Charlie was one of the few friends that stuck with us. You know, he was like, oh, I guess I just don't fit into your whole Jesus thing. No, you don't. You're a sinner. Oh, it was terrible, terrible. And so we go 3 years, no AA, only church, and it was ugly. And so I'm sitting at an intersection, and in Texas, they passed a law that you could take a right on red. Now, I don't know if you guys can do that in your country. I don't know what you people do in your country. But so, I mean, I don't know about you, but a right on red is better than any iPad, iPhone, iTunes, anything. You know what I mean? That was cool when that happened. And I'm sitting there at an intersection. I remember this like it was yesterday. And I am sitting there thinking, there is a woman in front of me. She is not taking a right on red. She has her blinker on. And I am going to shove her into the intersection to teach her a lesson under the name of Jesus. Yep. And I mean, I wanted to slap that woman this morning. I'm not kidding you when I say I'm pushing her in the intersection. I am insane with no AA program. Insane. And I got about 100 more of those stories. Thank God I didn't do it. But I got home, I called Jokes in the house, and I said, I'm losing it, man. I am losing it. He goes, you know what? So am I. And I go, what are we going to do? We're starting to hate the church now. You know, they're a bunch of sickos too. And, you know, every time we had a problem, we talked to the people in church, and they go, we are praying for y'all. And I think, come on, bring your stuff. They're, oh no, we're praying for y'all. So we ended up, Joe goes, let's go back to AA. And I said, let's do it, man. So we go to the noon meeting and we sit in there, and I swear, this is what I thought. We are home. I can't tell you that feeling. And I'm telling you, that's all God. God was everywhere. But the only problem was, when you walk back into Alcoholics Anonymous and you get that relief, it is not freedom in an AA meeting. It's relief, right? It's magic. There's plenty of magic that's happening. But you only get the freedom from the 12 steps, working them. It's an action program, not sitting in meetings. Now, I didn't know any of this was going on. Heck, I didn't know I hitched my wagon in the middle of the road AA. I didn't know I was doing meeting-based sobriety. But what Joe and I did from that day forth, we never touched our big book. We'd done the AA program. By this time now, I had 6 years. He had 9. We're long into this deal. And so we sat in Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years, getting the relief, but not the freedom. Never even occurred to us to pick the big book up. And I'm sponsoring people. I know. I was a good life coach, people. You bring your problem to me and we'll talk about it. And I'll teach you how to set boundaries. Good boundaries. Oh, I know. Isn't that terrible? I don't know what's worse, that or Jesus. And I'm a likable individual. I'm I attract people to me. You know, I'm funny. I'm this, I'm that. Oh my gosh, you guys, it was just crazy. Well, then here it comes. You know, it says it's the highs and lows that come at us in life. Well, let me put it to you this way. Joe gets sick. All I can tell you is when he got sick, you talk about driven. Now, I'm the gal who will take care of everything, right, ladies? Are y'all with me? I can bring home the bacon, fry it up in the pan. You need a baby? Let's pop another one out. What do you need? What do you need? Come on. Bring it on. Bring it on. I mean, the insanity behind women is crazy on the level of what we think. I always love to look at the women on this one. They're like, oh, sister, I'm right. Yeah. Pregnant with twins, I can do it. I can do it. Yeah. I sponsor a little gal who's a single mother, and she was pregnant with twins. I'm like going, what? I can do it? I'm like, oh, my God. And she's doing it. Now, it's unbelievable. But what we women take on, so I take on so much when I find out Joe is sick. I mean, I am doing all kinds of stuff, and we have no medical insurance. So you know what my best thinking is? Somebody says to me, I have the fitness profession I've had for years. Somebody says to me, you know, if you drive a school bus, you can get medical insurance like that. And I thought, I can do that. I love kids. I can do that. And so Oh my God, did you hear what I just said? Drive a school bus? Oh my God. I mean, at the time it sounded like a great idea. And then I am driving that big old tube down the road with 70 screaming kids, and I'm thinking, oh, I am in over my head. Oh my God. I mean, oh my God. You know, and you're watching everything in that mirror, you know, hey. Sit down. You, hey, where are your hands? Hands up in the air, buddy. Be touching that girl next to you. Oh my God. I got so many bus stories, they would just crack you up. But I tell you, you know, when we're talking about that sense of entitlement, you screwed with me on that bus, and you know what I did? I just popped that stop sign out. I was like, go ahead, try to pass that baby now. I mean, I was insane. There was a little 16-year-old kid that would drive too fast past my bus. I popped that sign out. I got out of the car. I went over to him. He's eating a sucker, you know, and that stick sticking out. He goes, lady, you didn't have to get out of the bus. And I am just, you know. And all the kids are just, oh, my God, Miss Kate is losing it, man. See, when it talks about self will run riot, oh, yeah, I don't think so. He's a little punk. So, when you're awakened, you get to see all of that stuff, right? Well, we're in the hospital. I got only 5 more minutes, but I want to wrap this up because this really gets wild. Joe finally goes to the emergency room. I said, Joe, listen, I'm driving that god dang bus. I'm pulling off 5 other, you know, things in the fitness business. I'm spinning plate after plate. And you've got to get into the doctor to find out what the hell is wrong with you, man. We couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. And one psychiatrist said, I think it's organic. What does that mean? You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, words, it's like, what does that mean? Well, that means something's growing in you. And so we get him into the emergency room, and this doctor comes in. I tell Joe, I said, whatever you do, you fail this test. We're getting a CAT scan. We are not leaving because I'm thinking I am not going to stay on that bus forever. We're getting a CAT scan. If I got to push you in there and hit the button. And so he goes, I said, so when that doctor tells you, you know, touch your nose, touch your elbow, you know, when he says rub your head, rub your stomach, you know, so I'm giving all these tests. So we go in there and the doctor goes, so you think something's growing in him? I said, yeah, the psychiatrist said something's organic, and the physician said, we need a CAT scan. And so, and he goes, well, he goes, Joe, touch your nose. And Joe goes, and he's like, touch your elbow. And Joe goes, and I thought, oh my God. Well, long story short, the guy ran several other question tests and he started failing them terribly. And so he takes him in there and he does a CAT scan and comes out and he goes, my God. He says he's got a huge mass in his brain. And he said it's about the size of a grapefruit and it's gigantic. And if this program is what it says it is, and the root of my problem is selfish and self-centered, you know what my very first thought was? I'm going to drive that damn bus forever. That was my first thought. That's how awakened I am to the level of self-centered I am. And I didn't say it, but it was like, oh, God dang, I'm going to drive that bus forever. I love my husband. Didn't mean I didn't love him. But that is the root of my problems, guys. I drove that bus for 3 more years. My husband was a very, very sick man. I take untreated alcoholism very seriously. I think we're sitting in the rooms of AA dying of it. I mean, if you don't know where your big book is, if you haven't read your big book, if you're not sponsoring, if you're not doing an active 10th step, if you haven't done a 4th step in a long, long time, you probably suffer in some part. And I told God I did not want to be the one to share this message, by the way. Because, see, my popularity is going to drop quickly right here. And all of a sudden, I was the fun, cute one, and now she's kind of bugging me. But the truth of the matter is my husband, who was not going to die of this brain tumor, at first they thought he was going to die, then they go in there, he has massive brain damage, he's never going to work again, he's got about the mind of about a 16-year-old, but I love him. You know, we're going to make it. We're going to make it. That's the kind of gal I am. And he ends up dying of a heroin overdose. Yep. And you know what? It wasn't the brain tumor. I wanted to believe that forever. We were in untreated alcoholism. He had absolutely no mental defense. He couldn't handle it. And I almost gave it up. 17 years sober, the obsession came back for me. I'm telling you what, you know what? Pride can keep you sober for a while. How many people in this room know what I'm talking about? You bet your ass. Charlie said to me one time, I said, Charlie, I want to drink. And you know what he said? He said, don't drink without me. And I thought, oh, that's so stupid. But I tell you, I thought, okay, I won't. Oh, man, you can white-knuckle it for so long. And Mark Houston fell into our world and Chris Raymer. And I'm telling you what, I didn't like either one of them when I first met them. I didn't like them at all. I had 17 years. You can't tell me anything. You know what I'm saying? And I thought, I don't know who this guy is. I kept turning him off and turning him off and turning him off on the CD. And Charlie goes, oh, for God's sakes, can we listen to the man? And I'm not kidding you. I went back to my meeting. I was going to 5 meetings a week. That curtain was pulled back. There was not one bit of AA talked in that meeting. You know why? Because I had to be at a meeting where there was no AA talked at. When you don't work a program, you darn sure don't want to go to a big book study. No, thank you. I want to just talk about whatever I want to talk about. You know, when the book says we're always in collision with something or somebody, that was my meeting. You could say it never grew. It was only 15 of us. It stayed 15. You came in. We were so toxic, right? We're always in collision with something or somebody. And I mean, that's what we did. And then all of a sudden we stumble into Mark Houston's big book study. And I kid you not, I remember Charlie going, good God, what book is he reading out of? I go, I don't know. I've never heard it. I have never heard it. I am shocked. And I don't like him either. And they send us back to our room, right? And Charlie's doing the evening review because he's such a suck up, right? You know, and he goes, aren't you going to do the evening review? And I went, absolutely not. That is ridiculous. You know, and I come back in there, and I remember I took Mark off, and I'll never forget this. If you knew Mark well, you knew this laugh. He goes, ho, 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 ho. And I told him something that was very serious, and he did that laugh. And I thought, oh, I really don't like you now. I mean to tell you, I am so grateful for those two men. They literally pulled me, and I'm not an easy one. I am a very tough bird. I got so much pride. I told you, you know, I left home at 15. I finished school. I am tough, tough, tough. And those two boys pulled me out. God sent them to me knowing that that's how hard-headed I am. And they pulled me out. And I got to tell you guys today, I work an AA program like you wouldn't believe. And as a matter of fact, when I know it's getting tough and I got that inner feeling of it just ain't right, I can't really figure out what's going on and I'm sick of looking at it, I throw myself so knee-deep into working with others. I probably sponsor 25 gals, man. I'm calling them. They're calling me. I don't miss a phone call because that seems to work when nothing else does. You know, the book says that. It says it works when nothing else does. You know what nothing else is? Calling my sponsor, blah, 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 blah. Right? Doing an inventory on it, kind of, sort of see it. Yeah. He's still bugging me. Okay. Right? I mean, all these things, I go, I'm not getting through it, man. I'm either self-righteous or self-pity. I flip between the two. And, I mean, it's terrible. It's terrible, terrible, terrible. You know what I'm talking about, right? You know that level of mental obsession behind whatever. Oh, my God. And so, I know I'm out of time, but I just want to tell you guys that I'm so looking forward to how all three of us work together this weekend. I do hope you vote for me.
My name is Chris, very grateful recovered alcoholic. Yes. I'm honored to be here. Gosh, it's great, like old home week. Some of y'all I know well, and some of y'all I haven't met yet, and I'm just honored to be here. It's just I was talking earlier. This is gonna be fun with Katie and Charlie this weekend, and I know some of y'all are not gonna be able to be here tomorrow, and you're gonna miss a hoot because it's. Sometimes you catch some resistance in audiences when you're coming out of the big book and you're a little thumper and, you know, people don't agree with you, you know. You ought to try to share the podium with people like that. You with us? And it's like a cat fight the whole day. And it's like, you know, well, this is what I really meant to say and I didn't intend to mean it. And everybody walking on eggshells. And so I just, This will be fun. We're going to come at this tomorrow with an idea of how we take a newcomer through the steps at a pretty quick pace. We're going to walk through the steps at a pretty quick clip. I think one of the biggest mistakes we make in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell you this, in all the 12-step fellowships, we just make this so freaking complicated that half the people out there just lose interest before they're halfway through. It's just not that complicated. I got to say this stuff going in the door and kind of give you a little point of reference. I nearly died getting to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm also a member of some other fellowships, and I dearly love anybody that's trying to get well. And I think I just need to say this, guys. I've been sober, I don't know how long, 22 years now. I got sober in 1987, and I spent a lot of time speaking from podiums early on. I'm really shy, except when I get from behind this podium, and then God kind of kicks in, and I kind of go 100 miles an hour, and I have a reputation for cussing from the podium a lot, and you know, I don't care what you think, kind of an attitude. And I just got to tell you, folks, I haven't cussed from the podium in years, and I care what you think. I get a little tired of being introduced as the asshole from hell, you know? You know, I had a circuit speaker friend of mine say one time, you know, he says, Chris says from the podium what everybody in the room would like to say at certain times, but doesn't have the cojones to do it. And I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the bad guy. I talked to Mark a lot before he passed away. Over the years, I became quite sensitive to the fact that I was, you know, when you walk in a room and you got some people, I mean, come on, guys. Some of us we've swapped spit for years. You know, we're thick as thieves. And some of us, you know, it's like you walk in the room and people, they don't like you for what you haven't even said yet. Y'all understand? They're sitting in the rooms waiting to be pissed off. And it's like, you know, our fellowship is full of those people, and I can appreciate that. Y'all all like everything I've got to say. Chris, we appreciate your passion. We love you. Until I say something that you don't agree with. You with us? Katie and Charlie, they were just talking about the same thing, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, I can't believe he said that from the podium. That's just, you know, it's like, guys, man, buddies. One of the first things that Mark talked to me about was, let's look at your truth based on your experience. Not a head full of knowledge. Well, I don't know if this will work, or I don't know if that'll work, but it sounds good. What's your truth based on your experience? If going to 90 meetings in 90 days and spouting one-liners has got you sober and is keeping you sober and you're a happy little camper, how cool is that? Rock on. This is the bomb. You're welcome to do that. Y'all follow? It's not what the big book says. That's okay. But in the same breath, those meetings nearly killed me. That's my experience. Middle of the road solution. Watered down, weakened program, message. Nearly took me to a suicide attempt in 1987. And that's my experience. And that's just, I want to show you my truth based on my experience. I get thousands of emails from folks all over the world, thanks to a great, I work at a hospital, at a treatment center down in Texas, and I'm sitting in front of a computer terminal with an 800 number right there. You know, so I get to talk to people from all over the world, and the cats that pick up these stupid CDs over the last 20 years, and they all want to show, you'd be amazed how many people can relate to what we're talking about up here. But it also takes the breath away when we come into a group of people and folks want to take shots about something they don't know nothing about. You know, it's like, it's my right to be 10 years dry in Alcoholics Anonymous, bone powder dry, miserable, you with me? Contemplating suicide or homicide on a daily basis. But that's perfectly okay. And it makes me sad to watch because Bill Wilson paints a completely different picture out of the book. And we're gonna talk about it some tomorrow. He talks about a program where we can be absolutely free and comfortable in our skin and excited about our lives. I mean, how sad it is that because some of us speak with passion from the podium, that we're the controversial ones. You follow? I mean, Katie said this something. She said, I feel comfortable in these rooms. I got to tell you, I feel comfortable in this room because I know so many of you, you know? And I mean, people that usually ask us to speak are not people that, I mean, we get the big book thumpers. We nest them out, you know? And so we're all like kind of in the same trench. But I mean, guys, I've sat in meetings where I felt lost. As we go around and share, and I'm listening, and I says, what? I was in a meeting in San Antonio not long ago, and I was talking to some of y'all about it. And I'd been on a bike ride down in down by the Alamo, and the Alamo's on Houston Street. Some of y'all come for the International next week, and we'll show you the Alamo. It's a pretty cool little place. But you can go left, like east of town, straight out Houston, and you'll see in some of the poorest parts of San Antonio is really sad. You know with this, and I'm out riding bike down that road, and I'm the touring the neighborhoods, and it's just the poverty and the just the blatant public drug abuse and alcoholism. Y'all follow? And I said, God, I want to go to a meeting. I am so grateful that I'm in a fellowship 22 years sober, and I've got a place to go, and we can talk about the steps in God. Anyway, I go to this meeting I'd never been to before, and there was a CA meeting, and I was going to go to the earlier meeting. I says, is there a meeting upstairs? And this guy stands at the door, and he says, yes. I said, okay. What time does it start? 7:30. He's just upstairs. I mean, he's irritated, you know? And I walk upstairs and I walk into the room and there's a little circle triangle sitting on the floor. It's a little tag sitting on the floor. And I walk in. I said, well, that's the meeting. And I walk in. There's 10 or 15 people in there. Actually, there's 11 because I counted them. There's not a big book in the place. I've got my big book because I brought it because I'm going to an AA meeting. You'll follow? And we read how it worked. And there's a living sober book there. Oh my God. I guess I knew we were in the right room now. I want to puke. And they got a daily reflection, blah, blah, blah. But we don't have a big book in the place, right? So we go around the room and we start to share. And it dawns on me, because nobody's talking about the steps or God or alcoholism. You'll follow. I'm thinking, if I was a newcomer in this meeting, what would I think? What message would I get? You'll follow? You know, flashback to 1980 when I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and walked up the steps. And they said, Chris, do you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, yes. And they said, welcome. And that's the last we talked about it. You know, lady was having a problem in the relationship, and we did. We talked about boundaries for an hour. And I went home, and I said, honey, we need to go to therapy. We need to set some boundaries up in our relationship. And I said, she said, I thought you were going there to stop drinking. And I said, yeah, I know, but we never got around to talking about that. Maybe tomorrow night. God almighty. Oh, my gosh. So in the short time I got with you, I mean, I'll give you the little gist of what we're going over, but I just want to share with you guys, man, my story, it's my experience. If it doesn't jibe with your experience, buddy, that's just okay. I got to tell you, in the United States, some of y'all have heard me talk about this before, but you know, we went through some major transitions in the 70s and 80s in the treatment center field in the United States, and we scooped up a big old net out there for a long time, and we caught everything that we could catch. You with us? Insurance companies paying like slot machines back in the States and back there in the day, and we got ever. Y'all know any of y'all ever seen fish? Y'all ever did? You don't ever know what you're gonna pull in, you know? And the smart people, they'll keep the fish they want and they'll throw the rest of the way. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't do that. You know, we caught every little fruitcake and knucklehead in the world, every little disco drunk and party animal, we just scooped them up. Well, if you think you might have a problem with alcohol, you're welcome. How cool is that, you know? And they come into the meetings and they don't any more have a problem with alcohol than a man in the moon. Y'all understand? But they're here, and they're staying, and they're the vocal majority in our fellowship today. You can get upset about it if you want, but at a certain point in our history of Alcoholics Anonymous, we stopped qualifying the alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic if I say I'm an alcoholic. No, you're not. I've seen these people's Facebook pages. They suck. I don't know what to tell you. You're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous if you say you are. Y'all follow what I'm saying? Anybody can be a member of our fellowship. And I'm not saying anybody can't. You're welcome. But the book spends the first 100 pages trying to explain to you the 12 steps. 60 of those pages qualifies the alcoholic. Walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. It's a duck. You with us? And why we have such weird meetings sometimes is that we got a room that was set up for ducks and everybody's in there thinking they're cats, you know, and so everything gets a little confused and a little goofy and this stuff. You can share anything you want, blah, blah, blah. But guys, we're dying of this fatal progressive illness. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only game in town. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said, oh, I bet you're excited about everybody coming into San Antonio. You know, it's in my backyard. I mean, the International Conference. I'm going to tell you, I'm dreading it. Y'all understand? I'm loving it because I get to hug all my little real alcoholic, my brothers and sisters in this fellowship. I get to know. But how, this place is not going to be peopled by them. It's going to be peopled by the little one-liners from hell. You with us? Oh, I get to hug. Oh, one day at a time, Mike. Oh my God. Who hasn't sponsored anybody in 20 years? But he goes to a meeting every day. Y'all follow? Can't hardly wait. I don't know. What we're starting to see is the same thing that Charlie and them were saying and Katie was saying. We're seeing these little pockets grow up all over the world, folks. Little groups of folks that have come out of the closet with big books and dusted them off and said, you know what, we're gonna start talking about the solution the way they did in the olden days, and we're gonna get us some little knuckleheads to come with us, and I gotta tell you guys, some of you folks that I've met in here, Scott and here, I met early on in Toronto a gazillion years ago, but I'm gonna tell you, we took so many shots for talking about the big book from the podium. I mean, people get pissed, you know? I mean, downright irritated with us. And the world has changed a bunch, and there's so much more of us out there. Why? Because, guys, guess what? The best kept secret, which is in the big book, the 12 steps, we're finding that actually works. We've got cats that are so pumped about this work. That's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. And it's going to be uncomfortable for some of you because you're so, what's the word? I wouldn't exactly use that word, but yeah, rigid comes to mind. I'll give you a classy example. You know, when we talk about the newcomer, we want you to be open-minded and willing, you know, and we talk about the newcomer, but what about the 22-year sober guy? But you don't have to be open-minded, just the new guy. I mean, it's just like, when does the journey stop? We were laughing. Our little big book study coincides, and we were reading with a bunch of little mad dogs last night in Bill's story. And I've read Bill's story a million times. I come from a group where we study the literature over and over. And I'm sitting up there, and I got 40 guys in the room, and we've got our little books open, and we're reading Bill's story. And I'm not going to tell you which line it is, because you'll go, God dang, I thought he knew something. He's stupid. But I read this line, and it took my breath away because I had never seen it before. I'd never noticed it from that direction before. And this is what, I mean, the book speaks to us the longer we're sober. I used to be one of these big, Microsoft at work. We use the Microsoft soft systems, and I had a computer at home. It's the same kind of deal. You with us? And I had a friend in Phoenix that kept saying, Chris, you ought to try one of these Macs sometime. And we just have a little, I was such a snot. Listen. Go Mac yourself. I'm not interested in that. You know, I mean, I've got this works, it's great. I know how to do it. I've got kind of a narrow understanding anyway. I know how to turn the bastard on now and off, and that's it. So, but anyway, I was stuck in Scotland. We were speaking in Scotland, and the hotel rooms had a Macintosh computer in there. And it was like, I called down to the reception. I says, this room doesn't have a TV in it. Can I move to a, he said, it's on the computer, you know, and so he said, punch this. All of a sudden, I've got a TV, I got email, I got it, and I'm whizzing on this thing, right? I email Patty back in the States in Texas, and I said, buddy, listen, we really need to look into getting one of these, you know, he was like, y'all understand what I'm saying? It's a perfect analogy. I'm so rigid. This is the way it's got to be. And then all of a sudden, you open your mind to the possibility that maybe perhaps something else could be better. Mark used to jam me up. He used to talk about my agnostic belief systems. Of course, I was a Christian. I was raised in the Baptist church, and oh my gosh, and I'm not an agnostic. And he said, Chris, you're the most agnostic person I know. You'll follow? Because I believe there's a God. I just don't think he wants to have anything to do with me. I'm always worried about money. I'm always worried about relationships. I'm always worried about you with this. I'm just, God hates me. This is... And he kept talking. I said, don't you think that God could take you to a different place? The miracle doesn't stop because we stop drinking. That's the beginning. Sobriety. That's the beginning of our journey. And unfortunately, in our fellowships, we've gotten to a place, in all of our fellowships, we've gotten to a place where that seems to be good enough. And it's not. I mean, we're going to touch on it this weekend. It's just, it is so not. Mark used to say over and over, I smell more. I smell, a lot of y'all heard him say it, you know, I smell more. And it's in that, it just takes a little effort to get to it. And that's what this is about. It doesn't take near as much effort as you think. I was a professional chef for a million years and was pretty good at it. I wasn't such a good cook, but I was really quick. And when I found some of those outside issues, I got quicker. We could stay up all night long and clean and cook and chop, and everybody goes, oh my God, you're a super chef. What's that white stuff all over your nose? And I don't know. But, and we're drinking like son of a gun anyway. And I had some Europeans that took me under their wings and taught me some cool stuff. And I was pretty talented. And I come from a great family, folks. I mean, I got to tell you, Mom and Dad, they were wonderful. And my father was an alcoholic. And I've got a twin brother that caught the genetic bullet. Guys, we're going to talk about it this tomorrow in First Step Stuff. Alcoholism and drug addiction, both, folks, is genetic in nature. I mean, the jury's in on this. This is biological, not psychological. And I know a lot of you guys are going to disagree. It doesn't mean that we can't use some psychological help too, but this is, you've got to be wired this way to be one of us. And looking at each other. Everybody got real uncomfortable because you've been sitting in meetings pissing and moaning about the bad thing that caused you to drink. And I'm not going to knock any of that, my friends. Please, I love you. That stuff exacerbated it and made it worse, but it didn't cause it. Good therapy can get you past that. Some great medications can help you with some of this other stuff. You with us? At a certain point in time, I've done all the medications. I've done all the therapy. You with us? And I'm still thirsty. Oh, my gosh. And this is the hard piece to get people, because we didn't teach that in the 70s and 80s. We didn't teach that. We taught that this was causal. You with us? These little patients come into the hospital, and they're just so confused. We get them in primary. We get them all detoxed, and we tell them, man, listen, alcoholism is a disease, guys. You're not bad. You're sick. And they start to get some hope, and you can hear them in there on the phones talking to their family. Oh, my God, you're not going to believe this. Buddy, there's some hope here. I've got this illness that's causing me to do this. And they get really excited. You with us? Then they go to their first day in primary, out of primary, and they're sitting there with their first case manager, right? And the case manager says, so, Chris, tell me why you drink. Because I got a disease. I'm an alcoholic. Wrong answer. Why do you drink? Really? Y'all understand? All the air just got pulled out of him. And now we're back to causal. Y'all understand this? We gotta turn this around. Sooner or later, we gotta get back into the literature and understand what this is about. If anybody in here, please, has just heard me say that your external stuff is not important, you heard me wrong. It needs to be addressed. It needs to be looked at. It will stop you from following the dictates of the higher power. It'll stop you from finishing this work. It needs to be addressed. But we've killed thousands and thousands of alcoholics and addicts over the years in treatment centers by making that the issue and not the spiritual malady. Make sense? We never got down to the causes and conditions, exactly what Katie was talking about. The root of my problem 22 years ago was selfish and self-centeredness. And let me be the first to tell you, today, it is still the same. Selfish and self-centeredness. That's what ruins my day. I haven't had a drink in 22 years, but y'all with us? That's the illness. That's the untreated. Why are we seeing such an influx? We're going to talk about it a bunch tomorrow, of people with long-term sobriety who are losing their sobriety. You with us? Proving positive that just going to meetings doesn't solve the problem. Not knocking going to meetings. Hell, I still go to a lot of meetings myself, but the meetings are not what's going to fix the problem. It's the work we do. 1987, I'd been drinking. I was what we would call a functioning alcoholic. I got a lot of this other outside issue stuff happening, taking place in my life, but I'm holding it together pretty well. And I am not robbing liquor stores or going to jail or getting in a lot of trouble. I had a little some run-ins, some scrapes, don't you know? You know, but I bounce back pretty well and I'm dodging that nonsense, but I am miserable inside. Y'all follow? I've spent 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to address this. Every time I get my butt handed to me one more time, I walk back into Alcoholics Anonymous and pick up another chip. And then we sit down and we start talking about your day again. because that's going to help me stay sober. And then we'll go out to the picnic table and you'll tell me your story one more time about how many people you chopped up, put in plastic bags and buried out by the gym. And okay, and I, you know, I'm not getting this. You know what I'm saying? I appreciate your sincerity and I appreciate the love that you shared with me in that meeting, but I can't stay sober listening to your stuff. People are trying to be so kind to me and so gentle with me that they won't tell me what to do. Y'all understand that most people are explained when they come to our fellowship that the steps are an option. That it's something that eventually, if you want to downstream, you can do. I got to tell you a quick story. Because I just got back on the bicycles again. I sold all my bike stuff years ago because I was going to move beyond that. And I missed it so much, I went and bought it all back. You know, so that's the nature of the beast. You should see what I got now. But anyway, I drive a 20-year-old pickup truck, but boy, this bicycle is something else, I got to tell you. But when I first started riding bikes early on, right after I got sober in the early 90s, I went to this bike shop with this guy, this big beefy guy. Some of you, my buds in here, like it. And we're riding with these guys, and they're all athletes. And I'm not. I'm a little skinny guy, and I've always been that way. And then, so we go into this bike shop, and a guy looks at me and says, "We'll set you up on this bike, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do." And I'll never forget it. He looked both ways, and he said, "Well, we're going to give you some different gears than he has." And I'm thinking, "Bitch, yeah. Oh, that sounds good." He said, "Chris, it's no big deal, but what we're going to do is we're going to give you some lighter stuff to push so that you won't have to work as hard as he'll have to work. And you can keep up better." I'm thinking, God, I came to the right bike shop. This guy really helping me out, you know? There wasn't anything in me that believed that this guy wasn't doing me the biggest favor in the world. You follow what I'm saying? Paid extra for these little pussy gears he put on my bike. Y'all know where this is going. We went out and started riding with these hammerheads, and they're all out there hammering it like this, pulling standard gears, and I've got these little lightweight gears, and the guy that can't seem to catch up, that can't seem to improve, is me. And I'm so frustrated because I really want to get better. I can't get better because I won't work as hard as they're working because the guy let me off the hook. And that's what we've done in Alcoholics Anonymous for years. We've tiptoed. This is what we do with a newcomer. I know. Let the tape show I just tiptoed. I don't know. Y'all we're going to do a pantomime lecture tomorrow. Oh my God. But that's what we do with the newcomer. We want to tiptoe around. We don't want to tell them. I mean, how many times have you gone into a meeting and somebody said, "Listen, don't worry about working those steps now." This is how the newcomer gets so confused. The guys would come up with me and the little guy, I never forget him as long as I live, is up in Denton, Texas. And he had an old beat up book and had duct tape around it. The covers coming off of it. And he starts to slide up next to me and talk to me about the lady goes, "Come here like this." And I go over and see, what? He says, "Shh. Don't go near that guy. He's one of those big book thumpers. Listen, all you need to do is just go to a lot of meetings and everything's going to be okay. You just promise me you'll come to lots of meetings." Okay. And I said, "Oh, I will." 90 meetings in 90, I can do that. You with me? Was that lady trying to hurt me? No, she wasn't. She loved me dearly. She was trying to save me the headache of doing a nasty old four-step that she never had to do in order to stay sober. How did this lady stay sober? She went to 90 meetings in 90 days. You with us? But she wasn't a real alcoholic. She didn't need to work the steps. She didn't have to have a spiritual experience in order to do this. Y'all understand? This is what the book trying to tell us on page 34. Bill Wilson says it. Crystal clear. If you can stay sober on a non-spiritual basis, you're not one of us. Most people can stay sober on a non-spiritual basis. Whip them good. Threaten them with an arrest. You with me? A divorce. Let their liver start to crawl out of their chest. And they'll say, "You know what? I was just fixing to quit." And they'll put the old plug on the jug. And they'll walk away from that stuff and they'll be done. Because they have the power to do that. You with us? Fear can keep those people sober. Wanting to stay sober is good enough for them. Needing to stay sober is good enough for them. 1987, I got to tell you, folks, I've lost 3 businesses. And my health is horrendous. I'm hearing voices. Psychiatry has placed me on 7 medications a day. Antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, some kind of suppository thing. I still don't know what that was. I'm on so many medications, I'm glowing. Y'all understand it? And I'm drinking on top of that. And when I can come up with the money, I'm doing little some of them outside issue stuff. Y'all follow what I'm saying? And I am miserable. I hate my life. What Charlie said a minute ago was so true. You know, you drink drug in the beginning and it's just like, oh shit, where's this been all my life? You know, this is good. You know, at 17 years old, I drank my first bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine. It was about this big right here. And I'm walking back across that field and my head says, you know what? It's going to be okay. You know, for the first time in my life, I'm going to be okay. And that's just, the effect produced by alcohol is not drunkenness. That's not what the book is talking about. The effect is a sense of ease and comfort. I get well when I drink. And everybody wants to focus on the fact that this is the problem. If you just quit drinking, everything will be okay. It was okay for that lady that told me not to work the steps. But for the real alcoholic, you lay the booze down, your life is going to go to hell in a handbasket. Because we're not dealing with a problem with alcohol. We're dealing with alcoholism. I'm 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous and nobody will explain that to me. Why is it that more of us commit suicide in sobriety than we do out there drinking and drugging? Because we don't get better when we just don't drink one stupid day at a time. We get better when we have a spiritual experience and the obsession to use is lifted from us. We have treatment centers out there killing people today, telling them all they got to do is avoid temptation, triggers, and everything will be okay. And every time we talk about this all over the world, everybody laughs the same way, and then they go right back in meetings and talk about it some more. You with us? Every time you relapse, we're going to find out what happened, what triggered you. You know what happened? You didn't work the steps and have a spiritual experience. That's what happened. That's the bottom line. There's only 2 reasons that you will absolutely relapse. You don't know what the problem is, but you don't know what the solution is. Some of you will disagree, but if you'll think about that tonight, laying in bed, think about it. God damn, that little one-eyed guy's right. You don't know the solution, and you don't know what the problem is. You'll follow? Okay. It's like taking my car. It's broke. The mechanic says, what's wrong with it? It's broke. You got to get... What? What's wrong with it? That's what we do in AA. You with us? Little guy comes in. I'm broke. But we don't tell the guy what's wrong with him. That the spiritual malady is going to kick his butt. That alcoholism, a progressive illness, is fixing to reach up and grab him in the butt. And this is going to get worse. Y'all understand where we're at? We need to slow down. This is the first thing we're going to talk about in the morning. And explain to the newcomer what's wrong with them. So that they can have this urgency to finish the work. If you think you've got time to do the work, folks, then you don't understand what the problem is. Because it's grinding us up, buddies. This is why we're losing so many old-time members in the fellowship. 1987, I'm sitting in a small little apartment that my sister-in-law co-signed for me and up in Louisville, Texas. And it's a little efficiency apartment about the size of this podium. not much of an exaggeration, guys. And it's a cold Thursday night, and I bought a 12-pack of beer and went home and picked up a stack of return checks and opened them up. And there's the rent check in there, and here I am again. I'm 35 years old, and I bankrupted another checking account. Y'all know what it is? I own a business on paper. I've got a little screen print business, and I'm working for my twin brother, and I'm an accredited chef. I could go make a bunch of money, but I've got a couple of $100 in the bank. I'm living from paycheck to paycheck. You with us? I'm going to be on the street if something doesn't happen quick. And I'm just done. I've done treatment. I've done therapy. I've done the church. I've done 7 years of Meeting Maker Make It. I've got more desire chips than you can shake a stick at. Last time I picked up a desire chip, nobody applauded. I laughed. I am just wearing them out. You know what I'm saying? Because they know that I'm not going to stay sober. You just don't want it bad enough. You just don't want it bad enough. Not one of those guys ever told me to sit down and do the work. Not one of them. That's my story. I took a bottle of pills that night. Two bottles of Valium is what I took. And if I remember correctly, and I washed it down with some Black Label. And about the time those pills hit my stomach, I heard a voice that said, "Don't do this. Go back to AA." And I don't come from a family that takes this kind of stuff lightly. Y'all understand that? I got a beautiful family, but there's no note. There's no drama here. I am sick and tired of being a loser because that's not who my daddy raised. And, my gosh, you know, family members, they think we don't know what we're doing. I got to tell you, folks, there's times that's true, but mostly anytime that stuff hit my stomach and I heard this voice that said, "Don't do this. Go back to AA." I heard it voice twice. Rapid succession. "Chris, don't do this. Go back to AA." Not a thought. "You know, Chris, perhaps you should go back to AA." That was not the "Chris, don't do this. Go back to AA" is the voice I heard. And it freaked me out. And I've talked to a lot of other people that have heard similar things. But the hair stood straight up on the back of my neck. And I made myself sick. I lay down on the side of the bed and heard the voice again. And I dozed off, conked out, passed out. And luckily I woke up the next day. And I heard the voice one last time that morning as I got out of bed, "Don't do this, go back to AA." And I was so sick. I was so banged up. I went to the doctor and I went to work. And at 6 o'clock that night, I went to a meeting I'd never been to before. I knew where it was because a guy had showed me. Some of you guys that think these 12-step things don't pay off, this guy had showed me where this meeting was 3 years earlier. He'd showed me. I was coming out of a blackout. I called him on the phone, and he took me to a meeting in Louisville, Texas. And he said, "Chris," he said, "this is a nest right here of big book thumper fools in there." He said, "Don't go in there if you just want to go to meetings and get a date, because that's not what they're about. They study the book in there." And I remember I'm smiling, thinking, "That's good to know, you know." And I remember making a mental note: I'll die before I'll go into that meeting. I mean, I'm just not. Thanks for the warning, you know. I mean, I'm not going to do that. You'd never get laid in a group like that. I mean, why else? Why else would you go? And I, oh my gosh, but I was running late. You know how God was all over this. Little brother just said it, inches and seconds in some of these things. And I was running late and I couldn't go back up to this other town to go to this meeting where I used to go. And so I'm going to stop off, get a cup of coffee, let some people know that I'm back in the program again, and then I'm going to go on home. You with us? And I walked in the back door of this meeting and they were just like we're doing, they're laughing their butts off. Some of y'all have heard CDs. I've talked about it. They're all, this back in the day, we could smoke in meetings and they've all got 6 or 7 cigarettes out of their mouths. You know, you poor little guy. We ruined it for you new guys. That's all I can say. We just smoked one. Well, we didn't. Everybody's smoking too much. Ceiling's dropping down, and I'm walking in the room, and I wish I could describe what I look like. I never just. Y'all, I always look a little rough anyway, but this big full beard I had, and I always had food in it, and you know, and that big long hair. And that was the big joke when I got sober. Was that we didn't know if you were wearing an eye patch or an ear muff, you know, because. Just hard to look cool like that. I got to tell you, you know, and I'm 2 days without a shower, you know, and I have two things in my closet. I got a couple of Levi's and three Fruit of the Loom t-shirts. You with us? They come in packets of three, in case y'all don't know that. You can get a blue one and a red one and a green one, you know, and you get them, you wash them every time and a little pocket slides back over towards the middle. You know what I'm saying? You don't know if you're wearing a t-shirt or like pretending you're a kangaroo or something, you know, when you get the little pop. And here I am with these little t-shirts all sweat stained. I haven't bathed. You with us? I mean, I'm banged up and I'm walking in and they're laughing. And you know how we get, the word is hypervigilant. Y'all know what I'm talking about? You get very self-conscious about who you are and what you are. And they're laughing and I'm checking my zipper and a patch. And what are they laughing at? I know they're laughing. They're not laughing at me. They're laughing. Something else is going on in the meeting. There's 30 people in that room. You with us? And I said, I can't do this. I'm detoxing in this meeting. I'm right at 24 hours away from my suicide attempt. And I took one step back and this little girl snuck up. She swears she didn't sneak up on me. I didn't see her. She came up on my blind side and I stepped back on her foot. She got her finger in my belt loop. And I've shared it from every podium I've ever talked from, guys. This is a little 19-year-old girl in Alcoholics Anonymous, doing what she was supposed to be doing. You with us? You can't work with men. If she'd have been off in a little young adult meeting talking about young adult things, I'd have been dead. If it had been an old boy, you with me? I'd have just shoved you out of the way. She said, sit down, cowboy, you ain't going nowhere. And she set me down in a chair, and I sat. Boom. She's still sober today. And I am today because she gave a... because she cared. Her sponsor couldn't get to me. It was a long, narrow room, and her sponsor saw me leave, turn around and to walk out, and she said, get him. And she got me. You see how that worked? How God's going to use... We think we're so smart, you know. I don't know who I can help. You got that right. Your job is to show up and just be there. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, they sat down, and the chairperson saw me and gave me the high sign. He'd seen me in North Texas for years and gave me a big old up, you know, welcome back. And they said, chairperson took charge of the meeting. You know, it was the same old stuff. You know, it's like freaked me out. First time I'd ever seen a chairperson do that. You know what I'm saying? You got a guy in there practically dead in the back of the room. Oh, we got a newcomer. But I think tonight we're going to talk about relationships. I don't know what it is about it. We either want to talk about relationships or let's tell Chris how we got here. It's like, buddy, I know. Let me guess. Oh, shit. Let me guess. You drank too much. What are we doing? Oh, my gosh. Like, you're going to scare me into the rooms again, you know? Oh, my gosh. They didn't do that. They said, Chris is back in again. We're going to go around the room. You guys that have worked the 12 steps, let's share with this guy how our lives have changed as a result of working the steps. You with us? Wow. Yeah. That translates to those of you in the room that haven't worked the steps. Be quiet. The proper term is Pat. But again, it's like Mark used to say, I wish people, when they share their opinions, would say in a meeting, I'm sharing my opinion. Because the little newcomer coming in the door doesn't know that it's that you don't know. You with us? How many times have you guys been in a four-step meeting and the little guy comes around, he's just got out of treatment, well, I haven't done a four-step, but this is what I, you know, no. Shut up. Be quiet. Talk about what you know. Talk about what you have experience with, because that's what the newcomer's going to gravitate to. They went around the room that night and they talked about getting their money back and they talked about getting credit cards and getting married and buying houses and doing all the cool stuff. I'm less than 24 hours away from a suicide attempt, right? And this guy's giving me the one thing. This room is sharing the one thing that I need more than anything. And that's hope. Hope. Can you wake up in the morning and not obsess about alcohol? What a concept. And yet we want to paint this picture that every day is a day you might drink. Whoever got up earliest today is sober the longest. I beg to, by God, differ. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Again, we're candy coat. What kind of hope is that to give to the newcomer? Why in the hell stay sober a week? You're going to lose it anyway. Oh, my gosh. Good heaven. There's no hierarchy. It doesn't mean we're better, but good God. That's why we need the old timers back in the rooms, sharing their sobriety dates, picking up chips to show us that this thing works. I know I can stay sober a week. I've done it 1,000 times. It's that month that I'm having a little problem with. It took me 7 years to pick up a 30-day chip. Y'all follow? The next day, that night, the guy got around me and they asked me if I was ready to stay sober for good and for all, not one day at a time, for good and for all. He said, we're going to show you how to live life one day at a time. Are you ready to do this? And I said, yes. And the next day, they were on my doorstep. I hated that shit. You know with us? Because I've forgotten a lot of that stuff. I mean, I know what I said last night, baby, but this morning, and I'm running around cutoffs looking for my patch, you know, and who in the hell's out there? And it's the guys from AA, and you know the look, you know, he's got a little book. He's got a little big book, and he's like, you know, oh, no. And he says, I'm supposed to bring you back up. And he did. He took me back up to the meeting. We went to a 10 o'clock meeting, and we went in the back room. We chased a bunch of Al-Anons out of their back room, out of their meeting room after the meeting. And we got back down there, and we did a guy asked me if I had a problem with God, and I said, no, not a bit. And he said, he explained the third step prayer, and we did a third step prayer. We went to lunch and came back. He gave me a notebook, says, hey, let's start working on that fourth step. And I said, Mom, man, I'm not ready for that. He said, buddy, you've had 7 years to get ready. Start making a list of the people you're pissed at. And I said, psh, psh, your name's on it. You know that. And he did exactly what we're doing right now. He laughed. He said, "Yeah, I know. I expect it will be for a while too." And he said, "But I love you, buddy, and I want you to get well. And you're not going to get well if you just sit on your butt. You've got to get into some action." And 2 weeks later, I'm sitting on the tailgate of my truck, and it dawns on me that the obsession to drink is lifted. 2 weeks in, and I've recovered from alcoholism and drug addiction. And the obsession to drink and drug has now returned. Yeah. Guys, the same miracle that took place in Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob's life, these guys work in the steps quickly and they come out the other side and the obsession went away. And I know there's some of you in here that are still fighting this on a regular basis and the desire continues to come back. And I'm telling you, that's not, let's do the work. Because there's a reason for that. And that's just what we try to teach people in treatment centers. And the guys that I sponsor says, let's get its cause and condition. The big book says a price has got to get paid. It means that we got to start destructing this self-centeredness. And that's how we work the steps. My ego is so huge, guys. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. And unless that's what the steps do is they keep my ego right size. I don't want to be better than y'all. Y'all understand that? Don't ever hear me that I'm 22 years sober and I'm better. No, come on. But I don't want to be worse than you either. And that's where I spent all of my life. I could walk in, used to go drink at an ice house down there in Houston. You know what an ice house is? Old beer joint on the street, and they pull up the garage door, and everybody sits out in front and drinks. And you know, and I'm out there, and I always would put a tie on before I would go into this ice house, so I would look better than these guys. I'm hoping none of them knew it was a clip-on tie. You know what I'm saying? But that's the way it was with me because of my ego. I'm either better than you or worse than you. And it's all the same lens. It's all the same thing that's going to block me from you, and eventually it's going to block me from God. And by working the steps, I got spiritually connected. Guys, it hasn't been easy. My life has not been easy. It's been a wonderful journey, but there's been some huge sadnesses in there and some trauma, and good God. But I get to walk through it with your help, with grace and dignity. I wanted to commit suicide in sobriety one time around a divorce. It was a tragic deal. There was a little stepson involved, and that was just, it broke my heart. But not once did I want to drink or drug, because the 10th step promises had come true and it placed me in a position of neutrality. And somehow, guys, we got to get a whole bunch of people trying to represent this program the way it's supposed to be represented. This is about power. This is about permanent, by God, sobriety. This is about sobriety, being able to walk through stuff with grace and dignity and come out the other side and not walking on eggshells worried about the day you're going to wake up and think about drinking. That's, y'all understand where I'm at. And it's not the picture that is usually presented by Hollywood about Alcoholics Anonymous. We're a punchline of stupid jokes, folks, because the message has been so dadgum watered down, it's not even funny. We as a fellowship need to grab this thing back, 75 years old. We've damn near lost it. And what we're going to talk about tomorrow is how we can work these steps. And if you'll come back tomorrow with an open mind about this and ask questions and bring a little notebook, and if we say something that doesn't ring true to you or confuses you, let's talk about it. Let's visit about it. We can do it question and answer from the podium. We can also do it in at the breaks if you don't want to with us, if you're too shy to ask. It's not complicated information we're covering, but it goes against what a lot of us have been taught. And that's what makes us uncomfortable. You with us? I'm going to say this and shut. I cannot tell you how many times we've had these workshops and we've talked to people and people get uncomfortable and they come back down and says, "Well, my sponsor said," or "my case manager said," and I'm not knocking any of that, case managers or sponsors or whatever. But Mark used to say, if you can't reconcile it with what's in the big book, you might want to hold it suspect. Or how's this working for you? Because you're going to hear some things new. You're going to hear some things that may go against what you've been doing in the past. But if with a little open-mindedness, it might work a little bit better. It might change your life. And that's what we certainly hope to do. I'll say this because I know some of you guys are not going to be here tomorrow. You got work to do and things going and you didn't plan to do it. But I got to tell you, any of you that can join us, we'd love to have you. Those of you that can't, I mean, absolutely, you stay in touch with us because we sure would like to come across you again in our journeys. Little thumpers, we all end up running into each other. Somewhere down the line, we always end up running into each other. And this, I guarantee you, it's the highlight of my life. I love every one of you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.